Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hi, this is Jed Babin, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for George H.W. Bush, contributor to the Washington Times and author of several books, including the BDS War Against Israel. And you're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. And that bumper was How We Operate by Gomez. In spite of the leadership and the mainstream media in this country, and thanks to people like my next guest, we are learning how groups like ISIS operate. For the new listeners, Raymond Ibrahim is a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a Writing Fellow with Middle East Forum, a Hoover Institution Media Fellow, and a CBN News contributor. He's a guest lecturer at universities and governmental agencies, and he's testified before Congress regarding the abstract failures that direct American dialogue concerning Islam. He's also the author of several books, including The Al-Qaeda Reader, and his latest release, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Raymond Ibrahim. Welcome back, Raymond.
Hi, Audrey. Good to be with you again.
It's always great to have you with us. I thought we'd jump in with Iran, which is always, just became front and center again. Could you share about this supposed fatwa from the Iranian leaders concerning nuclear weapons? Could you share that with the listeners?
Sure. The best way to preface it probably is last week Obama made a video. It's posted on the White House website, where he's talked, it's addressed to the Iranian people, and in it he makes reference to a fatwa by the Ayatollah, the supreme leader of Iran, and apparently this fatwa from the Ayatollah says that Iran has no intention of using nuclear energy to develop weapons. And so here's Obama citing this as some kind of proof or evidence which of course is mind-boggling when you think of the context, because there's so much that's wrong with citing this fetwa, and we can actually, I can launch into it real quick. First of all, there's the concept of takiyya in Islam, which is basically it's a religious mandate for Muslims to deceive non-Muslims, especially in the context of trying to empower Islam. And, of course, developing nuclear weapons is one of the greatest ways to empower Islam. So that's one thing. Second thing, of course, is the Shia, which happen to be the ruling sect of Iran, are the ones who have perfected the doctrine of takiyya. There's historic reasons for this. All Muslims do and can practice it. But the Shia are always the ones that are most associated with it. So you have the doctrine of takiyya. You have the fact that this fetwa is coming from the sect that has perfected this art. And then, you know, the list goes on and on. Iran, for example, the same Ayatollah that Obama references in the speech that he gave where he was showcasing the recently developed weapons, his military commanders start chanting things like Allahu Akbar, death to America, death to Israel, all sorts of things that sort of imply that this nuclear development may be used as a weapon after all. The president of Iran recently, Rouhani, it's amazing because, you know, the irony of the timing, just right before Obama did this, he said that Iran's diplomatic negotiations with the world concerning nuclear development is a jihad, just like a jihad is like a physical war jihad, so are negotiations a jihad. And so it's just amazing all this evidence that we have that implies, once again, that yes, they are trying to develop nuclear weapons through this nuclear process. And you'll recall, of course, I believe it's at least twice that they found the enrichment of the uranium was such that it's for nuclear weapons. It was discovered before. So, you know, all the indicators are there that you don't want to trust what this guy is saying. And not to mention, even if this the Supreme Leader is sincere with this fetwa, well, you know, he's going to die soon or be gone out of the picture, and there's going to be another Supreme Leader, Ayatollah, who can issue another fetwa once they have nuclear energy, a fetwa saying, yes, now we can use power. And all this, of course, you have to remember, aside from the doctrine of takiyya, there's the Islamic concept of circumstance, which means that depending on the Muslim strength, when Muslims are weak, they preach peace. When Muslims are strong, they go on the offensive. So Iran, of course, right now is not able to tackle Israel, the West, America, and so forth militarily, so they're doing the diplomatic jihad. But once, of course, they have what they want, equal footing by having nuclear weapons and so forth, then it goes to the real jihad.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's incredible that this is, you know, well, I, you know, there's a lot of things you could say about why this president is even buying this, if he actually is. Because if we recall when he was on the campaign trail, when he was first on the original campaign trail, he mentioned that he thought that Iran, if we had nuclear weapons, that they had a right to have them as well. I think a lot of people might be forgetting that. Yeah. Am I correct that even in Kerry at one point, Secretary Kerry also said that, I don't believe he was referring to a fatwa, but he said that or made reference to the fact that the Supreme Leader said that they are not permitted by Islamic law to have a nuclear weapon? Am I right?
Yeah, they say all kinds of things. They'll say anything you want to hear, you know, and then they'll say the exact opposite when talking to their own people. So, you know, it's just, I guess this is one of the benefits of being bilingual and able to read and, you know, see these different videos, even though it's not a surprise to most other people because a lot of it gets translated. So it's just amazing. And, you know, to add to that, think of how many negative fetwas have been issued, destroy churches, kill infidels, behead cops, and so forth. And the Obama administration never mentions fetwas. I thought they don't talk about religious things, and yet here they're citing a fetwa that is created purely to deceive the West, and that's the one he's citing for Americans to hear and so forth.
Amazing. It's amazing. I shouldn't be stunned by anything coming out of this White House, but yet this is really, this is incredible. I want to talk for a moment about ISIS. And now, for the listeners, I'm going to be referring to some of the articles on Raymond's website, which I'm going to give the address for later, and I'll have in the after show, so that you can go and look for yourself. You know, Raymond, it appears that ISIS has company in attempting to cleanse the Middle East of Christians. Now we see this happening in Pakistan. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's happening in Pakistan. It's happening everywhere where the Islamic Jihad is, and it's under different umbrellas, under different names, under ISIS, under, you know, Boko Haram, under Al-Shabaab. And the names morph and change, but the same ideology. It's one ideology, and it's in sub-Saharan Africa, it's in East Asia, it's in the Middle East, of course. It's coming to the West, it's already in the West, in Europe, in certain areas. So yeah, and this goes back to the earlier thing we were discussing with Obama and so forth. These guys are very upfront about cleansing and getting rid of Christians and all infidels and destroying them and beheading them and so forth, very upfront about it, and yet it's not being acknowledged. And you'll recall, for example, when the 21 Coptic Christians had their heads sliced off on video, and ISIS made it perfectly clear that they were doing this simply because they are Christians, no other reason. And the White House issued a statement condemning the act, of course, but they just referred to them as killing Egyptian citizens, once again pulling it out of context, not showing you what's the true animus that's prompting ISIS to chop their heads off, which is religious hostility and so forth. So it's everywhere, it's apparent, it's under different names, it's one ideology that's the same. Been with us for almost 1,400 years, and yet we have this, you know, delusional narrative in the West that's the authoritative narrative.
Exactly, and of course, it's not just our president that's using that narrative. We're finding it all throughout the West in the leadership. You mentioned the 24 Coptic Christians that were beheaded by ISIS, and now it appears that they didn't do this on a whim either, that they were following an Islamic book. Can you share about that, Raymond?
Sure. It was revealed in the Egyptian press that one cleric, who apparently is moderate, or at least an enemy of ISIS, it could be for political reasons and so forth, pointed out that they used an Egyptian book, and, you know, that's the irony, because here we're talking about how they killed Egyptian citizens, quote-unquote, but they used a book written by an Egyptian cleric who basically was justifying all this, and of course that book is traced straight back to Islamic teachings, to the practices of Muhammad, and so forth. But what I thought was ironic, and it was important for me to relay this information, because it was kind of being presented as, oh, you know, it's so strange or unfortunate, but the fact is, these types of books are everywhere. Prominent. They're everywhere in Egypt as well. In fact, they're in Al-Azhar, which is, of course, one of the most prestigious, if not the most, Islamic institution in the world, which is in Egypt. And it's known that their curriculum and their books are teaching everything that the Islamic State is doing, from enslaving people to burning them alive, to crucifying, to beheading, to subjugating Christians and so forth. So it's just, you know, once again, you get this little story, which in itself, it's important, but then you find out that this is just a drop in a huge jihadi pool.
Wow. I'm just curious, is that book or these books, they're all based on the Quran?
Yeah, well, that's the conundrum that, you know, the Islamic scholars are having difficulties with. Sure, some of them are like, for example, Sisi, who wants to not have these things, but then if you're going to be the most prestigious Islamic university, you're going to, of course, have to teach what's in the Quran and what's based on the teachings of Muhammad. And if you're going to do that, you're going to have all of these things in them. And if you don't have that, then, of course, all the other pious Muslims are going to accuse you of being an apostate university that's trying to mislead Islam and so forth. So they're always trying to walk like a fine line, you know, try to present a good faith, condemn these things. But then when you're a university student there and reading the text, you're being taught all these same things.
Right, right, exactly. There was a video featuring, and forgive me if I don't pronounce it correctly, Dr. Yusuf al-Burhami, a leading cleric in Egypt's Salafi movement. It was recently publicized. It wasn't a recent, meaning this year, video, but it was recently publicized on Arabic media due to its controversial nature. Can you share what that video revealed?
Sure, Audrey. This is Yusuf al-Burhami, who's really the front face of the Salafi movement. He's actually associated to a political party, Al-Nur, or the Light Party, which is the Salafi wing party, and which is, you know, it's in the parliament and so forth, and they have the right to say this and that. In this video that he made, he basically said that, yes, and he gives, you know, he talks history and doctrine, but he says, yes, we should destroy all the Coptic churches in Egypt. And he explains the reason they were left allowed to exist when the Islamic Jihad came in and conquered Egypt in the 7th century is because there were the majority of the people there were Christians, and they stayed Christian for centuries because the occupiers were the Muslim Arabs, and there were few in numbers. But once Islam started to spread, once, you know, Muslims grew in numbers, then they started to destroy all the churches. But he's saying now, his point is, he's saying now we shouldn't destroy churches because we're still in a weak position. And by doing so, we might expose ourselves to Western powers, even mentions foreign powers, who may want to come and occupy Egypt, for example, on the pretext that we're persecuting Christians, which, of course, is what he would be doing. So what's interesting to me is, you know, tying this back to the Iranian fatwa. Once again, we have this idea that, yes, we're supposed to be hostile, we're supposed to subjugate, kill, destroy, you know, burn churches and whatnot, but we can't do it when we're weak because it might actually make things worse for us. It might counter, backfire in our face. So we have to wait. And so you go back to the Iranian fatwa. Yeah, he'll say we're not going to have nuclear weapons and so forth because Iran is not currently capable of defending itself in the diplomatic or in the international arena. But once they do have the weapons, then the narrative completely changes.
Well, so this, if I got that correct, that this cleric is part of the parliament or was part of the parliament?
He's part of the Salafi party, has a political wing, and
wow.
He's part of, you can say, the, you know, he's a top leader of its more, you know, clerical side, which is formally not part of the political wing, but it really is. Sort of like, you know, in Iran you have the president, but then you have the supreme leader, of course, would be, you know, Khatami and the guy who's issuing the fatwa and so forth. So, of course, this is what he's saying. This is what they believe. But they won't. And he even said also that we should collect jizya, which is, of course, extortion money from Coptic Christians, because that's what Islam teaches, that's what happened historically, but not now. Because if we do so now, once again, it backfires in our face. People say we're intolerant, et cetera. So we have to keep waiting and not take it. And it's just, you know, it's amazing to me how this sort of thing is constantly being said by these guys. We have videos of it. It's translated all around the web and books and so forth. And yet it's just completely, you know, ignored. And instead, we get the whitewashed, nice little fatwa that the President of the United States is citing to confuse people further.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, they choose not to believe the truth, actually. This is the truth.
Yeah.
So what they're doing, as far as this cleric, they're using the 7th century model as an example today. Because ISIS I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're using Muhammad's. They're actually using the whole development of the Quran. If you look at the Quran, you've heard the argument, and it's true that there are tolerant, peaceful verses in the Quran. If you look at it, there's verses that say there's no compulsion in religion. And, you know, you have your religion, I have mine. And they all sound great. Then you have the violent ones, fight the people of the book until they pay jizya and are subjugated and kill. And whenever you find infidels, ambush them, kill them. So it's always been strange, you know, how do you make sense of it? And how you make sense of it is you look at the historical career of Muhammad. And the Quran is really separated into two groups of surahs, or basically chapters. There's the Mecca surahs, which is when Muhammad first started his mission. And he was living in Mecca, and he was immensely outnumbered and weak. And this is where you get all the nice, positive, tolerant verses. Then when he went to Medina and grew in strength and went on the war path and the jihad and started getting stronger, that's when you got the violent ones. So it's actually, what we're discussing is even grounded in the Quran itself. And that's why it's so, entrenched in the mentality of the Islamic mindset of how to, you know, the modus operandi of how to work with infidels. When weak, preach peace. When strong, go on the offensive.
Amazing. And it's out there, right, for anyone to, Western leaders could, just as you're a researcher, but I mean, just as you or I or anyone in, you know, any of the listeners, we can look this up and we can find it out, but yet they don't choose.
You're not going to find it. You're not going to find it in a. You're not going to find it in a well-known university or academic department, of course, because they're part of the mainstream narrative, which is Islam is beast, and all our problems really begin with the colonial era. Yeah, exactly.
This doesn't have it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, it's funny if you look at older writings, including from America's founding fathers and, you know, philosophers, people like Winston Churchill, people that everyone respects and looks up to. And but you don't even realize they ever talked about Islam. If you dig in those writings, you're going to find everything we're talking about. They said it, and they believed it. And it's amazing because by today's standards, all these people were Islamophobes. Marco Polo, you know, in the 13th century, you read his writings, you know, and he writes decent things about other people. He talks, for example, about Buddhists, Hindus, and it's not like he's, you know, being xenophobic or anything like that. But when he talks about Muslims, he says it's their doctrine to plunder the infidel, kill him wherever they find him, enslave people, behead them, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, you know, a book from 700 years ago, and the same thing there. So it's just amazing. This is one of the most well-documented things, but in our day, in our era, it's one of the most hidden and obfuscated things.
Yeah, obfuscated, definitely, for sure. Just one last thing. I want to go back to Pakistan for a second. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attacks, but according to this administration, they are not terrorists, nor do they have terrorist connections.
Yeah.
Is this credible?
Well, the short answer is no, it's not at all. Of course, they're terrorists. They're doing this. This administration, you'll recall, took forever to label Boko Haram terrorists, and they were trying to just say, you know, Boko Haram, who were actually doing what ISIS was doing well before they started, in a more, you know, just as a dramatic fashion, captivating, enslaving, bombing churches, etc. in Nigeria, and you know, Hillary Clinton wouldn't even deem them terrorist groups. Instead, they were doing that for economic reasons, just like we heard from Mary Harf. They need job opportunities, and once they get that, everything will be fine. So, same thing with the Taliban. You know, it's that, you know, pathetic, materialistic narrative that the only thing that animates them are physical forces such as economics, political oppression, you know, et cetera. Once they have that, then everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And I'm being sarcastic, of course.
No, of course not. No.
Yeah.
The Boko Haram, as a matter of fact, they weren't getting the PR that ISIS is, so now, of course, they pledge allegiance to ISIS.
Yeah.
So you can't fight them, join them, right? In other words, as far as PR.
Exactly. And therein lies the interconnectivity of all these groups. You know, this narrative likes to treat these groups as disparate phenomena that are products of certain, like I said, political, economic forces in that particular region or that country or whatever. But you see the same exact pattern.
Exactly. And, gee, let me see. What could the connection be? So sarcastic, anyways.
Yeah. What's the underlying factor with all these disparate groups of different races, ethnicities?
It's a conundrum.
Languages. Yeah, exactly.
You're right. Raymond, where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books?
Thanks, Audrey. Well, the best one-stop place is my website, Raymond Ibrahim, just RaymondIbrahim.com. And that's where all my articles appear, all my videos, and links to my books as they're being sold on Amazon.
Great. And you have an email list there where they can sign up to get updates?
Sure, yeah. They can like it on Facebook or follow Twitter or just subscribe.
Excellent. And I will, as always, in my after show, post those links and for the information that Raymond just shared for you. Thanks so much, Raymond, for sharing your assessments again. And till your next visit, may God bless you and all your work.
You too. Thanks very much, Audrey. Take care.
Thank you.